more anti-state character, and the accelerationist and fascist factions will gain influence, I think, and that will lead in a different direction, neither of which neither of which I'm very optimistic about.
We have 20 seconds, but the subtitle of Blood Red Lines, your book, How Nativism Fuels the Right. You have Stephen Miller now briefing conservative Congress members, Trump coming out at CPAC Sunday. Your thoughts?
Yes, I think that the nativist influence is going to continue to rise, especially as the climate crisis deepens and more people around the world are displaced and come to countries like the United States seeking safety and refuge and comfort. This is going to provoke a reaction that those of us on the left and in the Democratic Party need to be conscientious and sensitive to as we think about how to build a world that can accommodate
everyone.
We're
going to have to leave it there. Brendan O'Connor, author of Blood Red Lines. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at KBOO.FM.
KBOO is hiring a membership director. Our membership director maintains relationships with KBOO members and listeners, create a process to meet or exceed fundraising goals, and manage the membership database. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit KBOO.FM/employment. Apply by March 15th. KBOO is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kate Brown extends her state of emergency for COVID-19 as state Republicans walk out for a third straight year, blaming her COVID-19 restrictions. A former Oregon State Senator wants to encourage more people of color to get COVID-19 vaccinations. And a warning about scams involving COVID-19 vaccines in Oregon. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 25th, 2021. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us. Oregon Senate Republicans boycotted the legislative session today. It's their third straight year of walking out. This time, they blamed Governor Kate Brown's COVID-19 restrictions. In 2019 and 2020, House and Senate Republicans also walked out, but they were complaining about a cap-and-trade proposal targeting climate change. The state constitution requires two-thirds of the lawmakers to be present to conduct any business. The Republicans demand an immediate reopening of schools and increasing COVID-19 vaccines for seniors. Meantime, Governor Kate Brown has extended her COVID-19 state of emergency for 60 days. That's until May 2nd. The declaration establishes her legal authority to make COVID-19 executive orders and carry out the Oregon Health Authority's health and safety guidelines. The governor pointed out that when she issued her first state of emergency last March, there were 14 known cases of COVID-19. Since then, the state's counted more than 150,000 cases and 2,204 deaths. The Oregon Health Authority reported 553 new confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19 today and 10 new deaths. Oregon's Attorney General has a warning tonight about scams that are targeting COVID-19 vaccine seekers. As Eric Tegedoff reports, there's a reminder that people do not have to pay for COVID vaccines.
COVID-19 vaccines have brought hope that there's an end in sight for the pandemic, but Oregonians are being warned to watch out for scammers looking to exploit the good news. Ellen Clem, who works with the Oregon Attorney General's office, is grateful there hasn't been a significant number of scams reported to her office yet. However, she says there are some things folks should watch out for.
If somebody contacts you out of the blue and makes promises, says things like they can get you to the head of the line for a small fee, that is a big red flag that it is a scam.
Clem notes people don't have to pay for the vaccine, and it's only being offered through federal and state partners, and was recently expanded to certain pharmacies. Scams took their toll on consumers last year. The Federal Trade Commission reports Americans lost $3.3 billion to fraud in 2020. Susan Turley volunteers with AARP Oregon and the AARP Fraud Watch Network. She advises people never to click on a link from someone they don't know and to engage their inner skeptic in general for offers that sound too good to be true. She says it took her 5 days to get an appointment for a vaccine and understands the process can be frustrating.
That frustration is what scammers feed on. Luckily, I have a grandchild, and I would say this is a good tip. If you have a grandchild that's very computer literate, they can help you out.
Turley says people also can call 211 for help navigating the process. Even for tech-savvy folks, Clem says it's important to be cautious about the information they share and with whom they share it.
It's a tough line to walk because we really want and are encouraging folks to get the vaccine. I just don't want people to lose their personal or financial well-being in the process.
Clem says people can file complaints at OregonConsumer.gov. They can also find out more about which scams are active in their area through the AARP Fraud Watch Network. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
It is a better record than most other states, but Oregon could still use some improvement in its distribution of COVID-19 vaccine when it comes to racial equity. Black people are running behind the vaccination rate of white Oregonians by about 0.1%. Yet, people of color have a greater chance of dying from the virus. Many African Americans, based on historic precedent, have serious questions about new vaccines promoted by the government. One former state senator from Portland wants to help change that.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
It seems Margaret Carter was born ready, the first black woman elected to Oregon's legislature back in 1985. She served years in the state house and senate. Now at 85, she's blazing a trail again.
I am taking this shot.
She drove up to the OHSU drive-thru and extended her arm.
Pfizer vaccine?
Uh-huh.
All right, so I'm going to just have you rest your arm right up here.
Okay. Carter says she understands why African Americans are getting the vaccine at lower rates, a problem of both access and mistrust.
A history of government intervention, because we go back to the Tuskegee days, but I want our community to know that this is safe, and I want you to join me in taking this shot.
And this shot...
And you're done!
My God, Danielle!
...came easily for Carter.
Tomorrow, the U.S. House plans to vote on a $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill that would send out payments to most Americans. Meantime, federal stimulus payments from last year during the pandemic will generate $112 million in extra Oregon taxes. It could impact about 877,000 Oregon taxpayers, all because of a quirk in the state's tax law. They'd owe an average of about $130 each from last spring's payments alone. Lawmakers on both sides say that's not fair, but it's not clear that they'll be able to reach a fix before the April tax filing date. Congress originally intended the stimulus payments would be tax-free. Portland Public Schools and Beaverton Schools are both trying to figure out how they'll get students back in classes. Portland School Board is looking at hybrid learning for elementary, middle, and high school students starting in April. Beaverton is also looking at restarting in-person learning in April. Both districts are still negotiating with labor unions. One idea they're reportedly looking at is simulcasting. Students who are not attending in person could get a simulcast of what's happening in class. Other approaches would have students in class some days and remote learning on others. California's eugenics program sterilized as many as 20,000 women who were behind bars between 1909 and 1979. Now, as Suzanne Potter reports, a movement is gaining steam to compensate the victims of prison medical abuse.
Advocates for women who suffered medical abuse in prison are asking Governor Gavin Newsom to include money for compensation in next year's budget. A 2014 audit found in California's prisons 144 incarcerated women were sterilized, 39 without proper informed consent, from 2005 to 2013. Kelly Dillon says at age 24, she was forcibly sterilized at the Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla in 2001. She wants to make sure it doesn't happen to anyone else.
This is about people who are trying to control and determine the worth of a human life. And that is dangerous and is diabolical.
Dillon's story is the focus of a 2020 documentary, Belly of the Beast. The state no longer performs forced sterilizations, but the 1927 U.S. Supreme Court ruling that made it legal remains on the books. Laura Jimenez with the nonprofit California Latinas for Reproductive Justice says she wants the state to create a victims' compensation fund.
It is a symbolic gesture of regret from the state. Putting money behind it makes it sincere, and it makes it more likely that the state will think twice about violating the human rights of people that are vulnerable and within its care.
UC Davis professor Jasmine Harris says by some estimates, between 70,000 and 150,000 women were sterilized by state and federal authorities during the 20th century, in some cases to, as Harris put it, prevent dependency on social welfare programs and the draining of public coffers. Women's advocates say medical abuse continues today in private prisons that incarcerate undocumented immigrants. Last year, a whistleblower complaint alleged five women at the Irwin County Detention Center in Georgia were sterilized and later expressed confusion about the purpose of the surgery. Azadeh Shah Shahani is with the nonprofit Project South, which filed the complaint. She says she wants the facility closed.
This place is not going to be reformed. What we really need is for this facility to be shut down and that people are free.
Since Project South's complaint, at least 57 women have come forward to report medical abuse, and several members of Congress have called for reform. This story was produced with original reporting from Ray Levy Ulleda with Yes Media. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Clark County Republican Central Committee has voted to censure Southwest Washington Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Butler because she voted to impeach former President Donald Trump. Herrera Butler joined nine other Republicans and all the Democratic representatives to vote for impeachment because of Trump's role in inciting the deadly Capitol Hill riot. But Clark Republicans are threatening to pull money from her future campaigns and putting up candidates to oppose her. Today, Herrera Butler was the highest-ranking Republican on a subcommittee on Capitol Hill looking into the security failures during the Capitol Hill riot. A type of voting that allows voters to choose all the candidates they support instead of just one is getting a boost in Washington State. Eric Taganov explains how approval voting would work.
An effort in Washington's largest city aimed at making elections better reflect the will of voters is getting some funding. The Center for Election Science is making a $70,000 grant to Seattle Approves and four other groups around the country. Seattle Approves wants to change the city's primary elections so that voters select all the candidates they support, rather than just one. Logan Bowers ran for Seattle City Council in 2019. He saw voters struggle with the crowded field of candidates and thinks approval voting would make the process easier.
If there's two candidates that have similar views, they don't have to worry that their vote's going to be split and then both candidates will lose. And so the net result of that is the candidates that make it through tend to be favored or approved by more voters than the current system.
The grants are being made to groups to fund polling and legal services for potential campaigns. Voting reform groups were also chosen in the San Francisco Bay Area, Austin, Texas, Missouri, and Utah. Troy Davis with Seattle Approves says the group will see if the city council is willing to pass this reform. If not, they could gather signatures to put approval voting on the ballot next year. Davis says the change would make elections more democratic.
It's the most effective, easiest to adopt, lowest cost, really one of the only few things we can do to make a huge impact for essentially no trade-offs. If we were designing elections today, this would already be the case.
Deborah Morrison also volunteers with Seattle Approves and says she doesn't like to choose favorites.
For me as a voter, it's much easier for me to say, well, I like these three people. I don't necessarily have a strong opinion about which one I like the best or the second best.
Seattle is ripe for election reform. In 2015, it became the first city to create a democracy voucher program, which allots voters four $25 vouchers that they can give to any eligible candidate in municipal elections. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The U.S. House has passed the Equality Act. It would change the 1964 Civil Rights Act to protect people from discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity on the job, in housing and other services, and in access to public accommodations like restaurants. The vote was 224 to 206. Three Republicans joined Democrats to vote for the bill. The House first passed the Equality Act back in 2019, but now it has the advantage of Democratic control in the White House and the U.S. Senate. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced he already intends to bring the Equality Act to the floor. Critics of this legislation claim it raises concerns for religious communities and women's sports. But supporters say it's important for the Equality Act to become law to once and for all ensure that LGBTQ Americans can live lives free of discrimination. You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it's time for the Indigenous Power Hour. Then at 8, Soul Connection. Tonight's weather, a good chance we'll see some periods of rain overnight, adding up to about a quarter of an inch. The low will dip down to 41. Tomorrow's weather, it'll be overcast with some rain showers and a high of 48. Things will clear out as we head into the weekend, for partly sunny skies Saturday and Sunday and highs in the low 50s. Today in history, on this date in 1870, Hiram Rhodes Revels was sworn into the U.S. Senate, becoming the first African-American in the U.S. Congress. The college-educated minister represented Mississippi. Our quote of the day is from Revels, who said, "Have the colored people done anything to justify the prejudice against them that does exist in the hearts of so many white persons, and generally of one great political party in this country? Have they done anything to justify it? No, sir." President Biden hails a rare move of bipartisanship and moves to strengthen supply chains. The U.S. Senate barrels forward with confirmation hearings, and the Postmaster General apologizes for service delays. With more on these stories, here's today's edition of 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
In a town that is so rancor with partisanship, to come together as Americans on this issue, I think it's very refreshing.
Texas Republican Congressman Mike McCaul and other lawmakers met with President Joe Biden in the Oval Office Wednesday to discuss strengthening U.S. supply chains.
It was like the old days. People actually were on the same page.
Biden signed an executive order to review crucial supply chains, including semiconductor chips, PPE, and pharmaceuticals. The confirmation process continues for White House cabinet nominees. On day two of his hearing for the Health and Human Services Secretary, California Attorney General Javier Becerra was asked about a lawsuit involving the Little Sisters of the Poor's exemptions to health care mandates.
I have never sued the nuns, any nuns. My actions have always been directed at the federal agencies because they have been trying to do things that are contrary to the law.
With near attendance confirmation to head the Office of Management and Budget still uncertain, Shalonda Young is emerging as a possible replacement. Young served as staff director of the House Appropriations Committee and already has the backing of Republican Senator Richard Shelby. Four Republicans and Democrat Joe Manchin say they won't approve Tandon. However, Manchin will approve New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haaland to lead the Interior Department. He cited her commitment to bipartisanship and energy independence. Manchin chairs the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, which has not yet voted. And William Burns appears poised to be confirmed as head of the CIA.
Outcompeting China will be key to our national security in the decades ahead. That will require a long-term, clear-eyed, bipartisan strategy underpinned by domestic renewal and solid intelligence.
Members of the Senate Intelligence Committee indicated their support for Burns, who served five administrations in a variety of diplomatic positions. After warning the U.S. Postal Service is in a, quote, death spiral, unquote, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy told a House committee policies are needed to stabilize the service's finances. He also noted recent failures in delivery service.
This is unacceptable, and I apologize to those customers who felt the impact of our delays.
Later in the day, the White House announced three people to fill open seats on the board that will determine the future of DeJoy's position. Talks continue over the formation of a commission to investigate the Capitol insurrection. House Democratic Caucus Chair Hakeem Jeffries dismissed GOP complaints that Democrats want a majority on the panel and don't want Republicans to have subpoena power.
This should be done in a bipartisan fashion. That is our intention.
Meanwhile, the top operations and maintenance official at the Capitol says the cost of the riot will surpass $30 million, including mental health services for congressional staffers and damage assessments on historical art. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
Native tribes are expecting a lot from the Biden administration and Deb Haaland as the proposed new Secretary of the Interior. They hope for a secretary who deeply understands tribal issues and is ready to act on them. But first, she has to win the approval in the United States Senate. And one Western States U.S. senator says he will vote against her. Also in Native news, an Apache stronghold is filing an emergency appeal. It's in a fight to protect Oak Flat. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana U.S. Senator Steve Daines is opposing Deb Haaland's nomination for Interior Secretary. He showed his disapproval during questioning at the two-day confirmation hearing this week in Washington. Haaland has support from Montana tribal leaders and Native legislators. Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas has more.
Many tribal nations in Montana, most recently the Crow Nation, support Haaland's confirmation, while Montana's Republican Senator Steve Daines has come out as one of Haaland's strongest opponents.
Do you support a ban on fracking and no new pipelines?
Senator, President Biden does not support a ban on fracking, is my understanding, and it would be his agenda that we would.
Yeah, but do you personally support a ban on fracking and no new pipelines?
Senator, if I could say, if I am confirmed as secretary, I would be serving at the pleasure of the president, and it would be his agenda that I would move forward.
While Senator Daines questioned Representative Haaland about critical minerals, trapping, semi-automatic weapon bans, and grizzly bear management, he did not ask her about how she will handle oversight of interior programs that impact Native Americans, such as the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Isn't the role of a cabinet secretary to advise the president on these important issues, not just follow him blindly?
Senator, the way I have always taken any position I've had is I feel that I'm part of a team. And if I'm confirmed, it's working with all of the other cabinet secretaries, as well as with President Biden.
Senator Daines said he will work to block and defeat Haaland's nomination, calling her a, quote, hardline ideologue with radical views out of touch with Montana and the West, end quote. Democratic Senator John Tester says he will vote to confirm the Congresswoman. I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
A group advocating for the protection of Oak Flat, a sacred site in Arizona, filed an emergency appeal this week in its pursuit to overturn a federal judge's decision to allow the site's transfer to a copper company. Emma Gibson from Arizona Public Media reports.
The emergency appeal is meant to speed up the legal process as March 11th approaches, the day the federal government is expected to swap thousands of acres of federal land, which includes Oak Flat, for land owned by Resolution Copper. If the land transfer takes place, the proposed copper mine would be one of the largest in the country, transforming Oak Flat into a crater and severing Apache religious practices there. Winsler Nosey Sr., the head of the nonprofit Apache Stronghold, recalled the traumatic history of, in his words, imprisonment on reservations. He says the transfer is yet another way the United States government is selling out the Apache people. Last week, the nonprofit filed an appeal to the federal judge's preliminary injunction ruling. For National Native News, I'm Emma Gibson.
This week, the Cherokee Nation Supreme Court ruled the language by blood is void and should be removed from Cherokee Nation law, including the tribe's constitution. The decision was in response to a case which determined freedmen have full rights as Cherokee citizens based on a treaty from the 1800s. Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. welcomed the decision, saying the Cherokee Nation is stronger when they move forward as citizens together and on equal basis under the law. The Cherokee Nation has about 8,500 enrolled citizens of freedmen descendants. Federal consultations are taking place Thursday as part of the National Congress of American Indians virtual winter session. The Department of Agriculture is holding a meeting on food distribution programs on reservations. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs is taking comments on whether petitioners denied federal tribal recognition status should be able to resubmit another request. The consultations are being held on conference calls. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
A former U.S. Olympic gymnastics coach committed suicide today, just hours after it was announced that he would face criminal charges for sexual abuse and human trafficking. John Gettert was the head coach of the 2012 U.S. women's gymnastics team. Gettert owned a gym in Michigan and has ties to disgraced Olympic Dr. Larry Nassar, who is currently serving a 175-year in jail term for sexual abuse of minors. Gettert is accused of coercing girls into training and then abusing them. He faced 20 charges for human trafficking and forced labor resulting in injury, as well as charges for sexual assault, racketeering, lying to police, and running a criminal enterprise. When his charges were announced midday, Gettert had an agreement with the local sheriff's office to surrender himself for arraignment in the afternoon. Michigan attorney Dana Nessel said, quote, "My office has been notified that the body of John Gesser was found late this afternoon after taking his own life. This is a tragic end to a tragic story for everyone involved." After a rough round of ice storm damage in Oregon, scientists are urging people to be more prepared for high energy demand in extreme weather. Lily Bulkey takes a look at one effort that's underway in Nevada, which relies on out-of-state fossil fuels for 85% of its energy, even though it has the highest solar energy potential in the nation.
In the wake of the devastating power grid failure in Texas, energy and climate scientists are urging Nevada to prepare its own power grid for extreme weather events happening more often due to climate change. A Reno-based scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council, Dylan Sullivan, says energy demand reaches its highest levels during extreme weather as people try to keep their homes and businesses safe and comfortable. He says whether it's a repeat of the August 2020 heat wave or a Texas-style polar vortex event, the Silver State needs to be prepared.
What we need to do is make sure that we have enough power plants and a strong enough grid in the state to keep power flowing on those really tough days when electricity demand skyrockets.
He says the question is not whether these events will occur, but how people can prepare for them. He recommends making sure homes and businesses are well insulated and using energy-efficient appliances and doing a better job of knitting together the Western energy grid that Nevada is part of so the grid is easier to manage in times of stress. Sullivan says his group supports energy efficiency legislation as well as better resource planning, including analyzing worst-case scenarios to make sure there's extra power capacity available for emergencies. He points out that Nevada has the most solar energy potential in the nation, but most of the energy the state consumes still comes from out-of-state fossil fuels.
It's made to sound as if we have to make a choice between a highly renewable, clean electricity system or reliability. That's not the case. We really don't have to make a choice if we plan for it.
He hopes to see Nevada move towards more locally sourced renewable energy and greater efficiency, both to reduce emissions and help slow the rate of climate change and reduce the risk of a power grid failure. For Public News Service, I'm Lily Bulkey.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 25th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips. Here's the number, 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegedoff, Suzanne Potter, and Lily Bolke. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us, and stay right here for KBOO News In-Depth coming up next.
Everyone, thanks for tuning in to Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. I'm Sam Kropp, one of your co-hosts for today. Today, we are excited to be speaking with two inspiring climate justice activists about their work supporting the city of Eugene, Oregon, in achieving a just transition away from so-called natural or fracked gas. We have on the show Avery Temple, a student community organizer and Latina activist working on racial justice and climate justice issues. Avery currently works for Cascadia Wildlands and is a co-lead on the Fossil Free Eugene campaign. We also have Anna Molina, a Latina environmental justice activist and advocate who's working toward advancing racial and climate justice for our BIPOC communities. Anna is the statewide environmental justice manager for Eugene's local Beyond Toxics organization. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
So maybe you can get us started with a little bit of context about this Fossil Free Eugene campaign. Could you give us a history that brings us up to speed of where we are now and what kind of work you're doing in Eugene?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us. Yeah, so the Fossil Free Eugene campaign really came about 2 years ago. and was kind of spearheaded at the time by our local 350 group, who had done some digging and saw that the city of Eugene had been negotiating behind closed doors with Northwest Natural for a while, and also that the franchise agreement 2 years ago had a lot of things in it that really wasn't advancing us towards our climate action goals. And so they started taking action, started, you know, looping people in, getting more folks involved, getting the information out about how Northwest Natural is a bad faith actor and wasn't working with the city of Eugene to move forward on climate goals. And then, you know, just kind of snowballed into like a larger community effort. And, you know, following the growing movement of cities moving away from gas infrastructure all across the country, we started really to hone in on this specific issue and make sure that it got the attention that it deserves, because energy is such, like energy justice in particular, is so important to so many households all across the United States, especially low-income and BIPOC communities, who are often the ones who, you know, have to deal with the brunt of the terrible effects of things like fracked gas or fossil fuel infrastructure. And so, yeah, the last 2 years, we've been doing a lot of research, talking with local officials, and it's really come to a head in the last 6 months or so, where we have been talking to city councilors, talking to local business owners, local unions, and other like nonprofits and grassroots organizations to urge the city of Eugene to walk away from the franchise agreement, because the franchise agreement as it stands now and as it has been for the last 2 years has honestly not served the people of Eugene at all. It really isn't much of a negotiation. It's more of Northwest Natural kind of, you know, holding hostage the city council and threatening them with bad PR if they don't give Northwest Natural everything that they want. So, yeah, we've just kind of joined the fight to make sure that this gets the attention that it deserves and that we are able to ban fracked gas in our community, and also make sure that we're able to tax local polluters and levy a fee on them to be able to fund the transition away from gas and towards electric appliances, as well as retrofitting homes for climate resiliency.
Seeing y'all's campaign and learning, putting all the great information y'all have put out there about frack gas, Northwest Natural, you know, I have frack gas in my home, and I didn't realize, you know, like some of the health impacts, some of these major issues going along with frack gas. So, you know, the proponents of natural gas say that it's a clean, green bridge fuel, but the work that you've done to help educate folks, and you all know that it's, you know, that's not the case. Can you tell us why it's called frack gas instead of natural gas? And from the point of extraction to the point of combustion in residential homes, what are some of the problems with frack gas?
Yeah, so some of the problems with this natural gas that we use to heat and power our homes is raising our greenhouse gas emissions and dirtying our air. Burning gas inside a home could create indoor air pollution. So sometimes, a lot of the time, the air inside our homes we think is cleaner than the air outside our homes, but it could be more dirty just because of like the natural gas. So any fire, but similar to the smoke of any fire, cooking with gas emits pollutants even when our appliances are operating correctly. A recent UCLA study found that after 1 hour of cooking with gas, 90% of our homes have indoor air quality that violates federal ambient air quality standards, meaning it would be illegal outside to emit that much outside. So, and then some of this has also impacts to communities of color as well. Sometimes increase a child's chances of developing asthma by 42%. And we know that communities of color do have higher asthma rates because they do live closer to air pollution as well. So there's all these like multiplying factors that contribute to environmental injustice.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with what Anna's saying. I think that we're really fortunate in Eugene to have organizations like Beyond Toxics and like the NAACP who have conducted studies around this particular issue, specifically pollution in our homes from fossil fuels and from fracked gas. And also, I'd like to add that, you know, Northwest Natural is trying to sell us, much like other fracked gas and polluters across the country, are trying to sell us this false solution of being renewable natural gas, which is false because it's saying that, you know, because this energy is coming from landfills and factory farms and it's mixed with hydrogen, that we're able to essentially like offset our carbon emissions. However, that's not the case, because in the end, we're still relying on these polluting businesses, polluting structures, polluting systems, all of which, like Anna said, are typically in BIPOC communities. And so typically in, you know, low income communities. And like the drift from that pollution indoor and outdoor also affects people's respiratory health, and you know, it pollutes our water, our air, our soil. And so if we're expanding fracked gas, we are also thereby saying that we're going to be expanding on you know, just pollution in our systems, like landfills and factory farms, and we're going to be relying on those instead of moving away from those harmful systems that we know should not exist in the first place. Also, you know, this renewable natural gas thing is a farce, because with that, we can't even meet 20% of Oregon's current demand for our gas, and it requires more pollution to generate RNG, which is the renewable natural gas. And so, yeah, it's just kind of a self-sabotaging cycle if we begin to move towards this false narrative that natural gas is clean or a green bridge fuel. It has never been that way. And just the way that it's built wouldn't be able to hold up to those claims.
Thank you, both of you. That was a lot of different reasons why we shouldn't be supportive of so-called natural or fracked gas. I want to build off of what you were just saying, because you touched on this a bit, and I know that both of you work in the world of environmental justice, specifically the impacts that these sorts of things have on human communities. And Avery, you recently submitted a letter to the editor in the Eugene Weekly that was entitled "Climate Silence is White Violence." I'm wondering, could you elaborate on why this particular issue is a racial justice issue? How are frack gas companies like Northwest Natural actually doing harm to communities of color on the ground?
Thank you for that question, Sam. Yeah, so it's a bit of a loaded question. There are a lot of different reasons, but I'll stick to some that I feel like are the easiest to kind of navigate through. So in general, almost across the board, BIPOC communities are the ones who are hit the hardest from climate injustice and from climate chaos. And so, you know, like in the last several months, we've seen wildfires that have devastated low-income and BIPOC communities. You know, people aren't able to find ways to make sure that their home has healthy air quality. And that's because, you know, it's really expensive and costly to make the transition away from gas and towards electric appliances. And that's definitely done on purpose, you know, with economic injustice that has always been geared towards Black and Brown communities and other people of color. So I feel like this particular issue, energy justice, is such a key component of fighting for overall climate justice. You know, when I think of us living in a beautiful, thriving environment and hopefully 10 to 20 years where we're like living with the planet instead of working against it, where we have systems that are really meant to bolster the health of people and the land. I think of how, you know, in my own life, I have struggled to pay utility bills, or I have, you know, thought about, should I heat my home? Should I pay for groceries? Should I, you know, like, what should I get, like a space heater? Should I do something else? Should I like make fires, which also like, you know, contribute to indoor, lower indoor air quality? And so I feel like the Fossil Free Eugene campaign really wants to make sure that polluters are paying for BIPOC and low income communities to then transition away from gas appliances overall and towards electric appliances, as well as making sure that BIPOC communities and low-income communities are able to make their homes climate resilient for future fires, for future, you know, like mudslides that we have in certain places from due to deforestation, who are subjected to outdoor air quality from like wood burning plants or treatment facilities. And so we want to make sure that we're really thinking in a well-rounded, holistic way about how campaigns like this affect our community and all the different factions that have that go into it as well. And so climate justice in general, it is primarily making sure that the most marginalized communities, which are Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities, are taken care of, that, you know, Indigenous people have a say in what happens to the land and, you know, how we treat the land, and that their traditional knowledge is respected and held sacred as it should always be. And so we want to make sure that, you know, within this campaign, we're encompassing that as best as we can, to the best of our abilities, by levying taxes on Northwest Natural in order to, or levying fees on Northwest Natural in order to pay for those transition, in order to make sure that, you know, people of color don't have to pay for, to reverse all this harm that polluters have caused to them and their families. So that's kind of like a little bit why I believe that this is a racial justice issue. It's just, it boils down to the fact that we are always the communities that are affected the most by this. And often we are left behind in climate justice movements and in climate justice campaigns. So really trying to make sure that that stays centered and focused in our campaign.
Yeah. Thank you, Avery. Yeah. I do want to add that it's like, yes, our communities of color, Black, Indigenous people of color communities have been forced to live in the places with like the greatest concentrations of exposure to air pollution. But we have to remember that that's like due to historical practices of segregation and redlining as well. And so that the burden of air pollution isn't evenly shared between all of us. And so, yeah, really centering the fact that like, who are the folks who are most impacted by environmental injustice? Black, Latinx, and Asian people, as well as people of lower socioeconomic status, already have higher risks of death from particle pollution, and lower income households may also be at higher risk of exposure to gas pollution because of smaller housing unit sizes, more people per home. We can live with so many people in a house. Older homes with poor ventilation and using stoves as ovens for supplemental heat. So again, our communities are also lack access to healthcare and grocery stores and other resources that can protect our health as well.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you so much for that excellent response to that question. This is a really important matter, and it's, you know, y'all are up against working on this campaign, you know, pretty well-resourced industry and Northwest Natural, and you know, they've gone out of their way, the fracking industry has gone out of their way to use propaganda to make the public think that this gas is natural and harmless. Could you describe some of the tricks they've used to sway hearts and minds in your community? And how is it similar to some of the schemes or some of the tactics that, you know, big coal, big tobacco have done in the past?
Oftentimes the fracking industry co-opts a lot of the language that social justice movement use in order to kind of like disguise their purpose and to make people think that it is natural and harmless. And so, you know, that's typical with greenwashing, where they're saying things like, oh, it's a clean green bridge fuel, when in reality we know that it contributes to respiratory health impacts, negative respiratory health impacts, and that it has devastating effects on our like local lands in terms of like building new infrastructure, that it increases air pollution in and outside of the homes, et cetera. So I think that like the language that is used when talking about these fuels is that it often mimics what, you know, those of us who are fighting against them is trying to say. So they try to make sure that it comes off as you know, clean and green and fresh and new and good. And all the while, you know, it's totally hypocritical. It's something that is definitely not accurate. It isn't clean. It isn't like an environmental solution. It isn't something that is like a just solution either. And so I think, you know, in terms of tackling that, it's important to quickly debunk those conversations or those talking points that they have. And also, I'd say, you know, Northwest Naturals here in Eugene has already multiple times threatened our city council with bad PR should they not should they decide to walk away from the franchise agreement. That has been like an open threat many times, where they say, you know, like, well, we're going to go after y'all as city councilors, as people who are elected officials, to sway the public vote. And so we see that happened a lot in other places as well. I know that that's happened in California, and it's true, you know, they have a lot of resources, they have a lot of money, they have a lot of vested interest in making sure that they're still lining their pockets with profit, with money that should really be going back into the communities that they've polluted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that as well. And also want to mention that I think when another thing that is like that draws either like people to it is the idea that it also creates jobs, like local jobs, because people will be hired either in the local area to work in building this natural gas infrastructure, when in reality that's not always true. When these projects start, there's no guarantee that it's like a local hire of the communities nearby. And then a lot of the time, not only are there health risks for like the surrounding communities, but the workers who like work for these new gas infrastructure projects are also still remain unprotected by federal standards, as oil and gas industries are exempted from the labor regulations that prevent workplace explosions. So it's like there's that draw of bringing in jobs, but in reality, that's not always true. And so I think that's one of the messagings that they use as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to also amplify what Anna said. And also, I think in terms of jobs, like just one other point is that a lot of those jobs, even the ones that, you know, are created through creating like infrastructure or through the fracking industry, are often temporary and don't have a lot of those benefits that they boast about, right? And I think that it's really important within climate justice movements and, you know, in talking about energy justice that we are discussing, what, like, how can renewable energy be a sector where people are able to be trained with new jobs, that they're able to be provided with jobs that are, you know, green, but also unions led and union majority, and that they're able to have the same like really great health benefits, really great pay, good like retirement packages. How can we make sure that they have, you know, all the healthcare that they need as workers in this soon to be like hopefully the only type of energy industry that we have? And so I think that that is like a huge struggle for the climate justice movement. And I think that we're already embracing and adapting and really taking that into consideration with all of the campaigns that we've been doing, is that jobs are important. People need to know that they are going to be taken care of if they walk away from these polluting industries. And that's what we want to do as a climate justice movement. We want to say there is a place for you. You will not be forgotten about. You won't be left behind. And we're going to make sure that you're taken care of. So, you know, when I think of the future, I think of like clean union jobs in the renewable energy sector.
Amazing answer. And thank you for directly addressing some of the propaganda that we're seeing and offering an alternative. Speaking about that alternative and what clean jobs can actually look like, I want to wrap up or move towards wrapping up by talking about what a just transition could look like. What could it actually be to move away from frack gas in our communities? What does winning look like to you in 5 years, in 10 years down the line?
I would definitely agree with everything that Avery said of like good paying jobs, union jobs, that communities are supportive. And I think one of the wins, besides this campaign and us breaking our contract with Northwest Natural and really looking at alternatives and solutions for our community, another one that I would also, I think, plays like a larger role into this is also the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign. So that's another statewide campaign that also impacts local cities as well. And so that's a campaign led by frontline communities across the state that are wanting to move towards more of like, what does a clean energy future look like? And so those are different bills that are being proposed that are also very similar to what this campaign is doing. Moving to 100% clean energy, making sure that there's energy accessibility for low-income communities who are having a hard time paying their bills. So I think for me, that's one win, and the win of this campaign and transitioning to a clean energy future for our state.
Yes, Anna, I completely agree with that. And also, in terms of the campaign that you're talking about, such a beautiful, robust, powerful campaign. I really encourage everyone to check that out. And also, in terms of timeline, like for me, when I think of this coming from the Fossil Free Eugene campaign, is, you know, tomorrow, immediately, we want to see them, we want to see the city of Eugene put a ban on building any new fracked gas infrastructure. That is what we want to see right off the bat. We want to see that in action ASAP. Yes. We don't want to settle until we get there either. And so I think also, you know, when I think of, you know, in the near future, I think of all of our new buildings are electric, that we're retrofitting, like Anna was saying, pre-existing buildings to make sure that they are able to make the switch in a way that is, you know, quick, efficient, that is putting people to work, doing a job that is good for the environment, while at the same time not being wasteful, not really neglecting communities and business owners and small business owners. And so that's something that we want to see. I'd also say at FFE, in 5 years, we definitely want to see EWEB transfer to 100% renewable energy by 2030, and an entire switch to electric appliances, and an electrified way of living. And so that's what we want to see. That's one of our demands. It's really important for us that we are making bold, important, necessary, vital moves towards a 100% renewable future as soon as possible, because otherwise we're just not going to be able to meet our climate action goals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Eugene prides itself on being a progressive green city. And so we really need to make sure that we're actually doing the work to do that. So that means getting to 100% renewable, and that we're ensuring within that same time that homes are safe for people to breathe, and also that we're dealing with our housing crisis so that housing is affordable, and also that it is climate resilient, and that it is, on electric appliances, that they are built for long-term use, that they're able to be updated easily, and that we're also at the same time updating older housing to make sure that low-income and BIPOC communities are taken care of. Mm-hmm. And sorry, I thought a lot about this because it makes me so excited. But at the same time, while we're levying those fees on local polluters like Northwest Natural, we want to subsidize low-income and BIPOC communities to be able to not only switch to appliances, but also invest in their communities for climate resiliency in whatever way they see fit. And in 10 years, we're really hoping that, and we're going to continue to fight for Eugene to be 100% electric and renewable energy, but also that our emissions are down drastically, and that we're able to, at the same time, address issues that create greenhouse gases like transit. And so we're able to make sure that we're thinking about public transit, that we're thinking about, you know, putting people to work in high-paying union jobs that are safe, that have great benefits, where they feel represented, but also where we're able to just move to a community that really, you know, is us living our best life as a community, that is centering Indigenous sovereignty, that is centering a community that is strong and healthy and that cares for each other, where people are able to have access to healthcare, where people are able to have access to really quality education, where we're able to really reckon with, acknowledge, privilege and begin the long overdue process of healing our trauma from racial injustice. And so I think that when I think about what winning looks like, I think about how climate justice is based on the healing of not only our planet, but also us as a people, because we are supposed to be living in tandem and with and in right relationship with the earth. And I think that, you know, that's what the climate justice movement is all about. It's always been centering indigenous and Black voices and making sure that we are moving towards the world that we truly deserve.
That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Avery, for that really inspiring vision. One quick last question is, how do folks get involved in the campaign in Eugene? How can they get involved in their community?
Some ways that people can get involved, at least in the Fossil Free Eugene one and the campaign here, is call and write to your city councilor. We need to put as much pressure on our city councilors, especially the ones who aren't supportive, to really move forward and support this campaign and the vision that we want to see. Giving testimony is always really powerful. They need to hear from us, not just like through an email, but also like showing up to these city council meetings and giving testimony of why it's really important and why it's so urgent. Because it doesn't need to just happen here in Eugene, but it needs to happen all over our state. Avery?
Yeah, I would say feel free to reach out to Cascadia Wildlands or Beyond Toxics directly. And I encourage people to also, if they want to become more involved, if they feel as if maybe their business or nonprofit or just grassroots group is interested in this campaign, to email me directly at avereydtemple@gmail.com.
Thank you both so much. That's about all for today. Again, we were just speaking with Avery Temple and Anna Molina about the Fossil Free Eugene, Oregon campaign. Thanks again so much for joining us for another great conversation with Coast Range Radio. Coast Range Radio is in all podcasting services, and you can check us out online and subscribe to get the newest episode each month. Thanks again, you two.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.